And welcome. I'm Darren Kaster, the host of The Green Majority. You're listening to, of course, The Green Majority. We're broadcasting here live out of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto every Friday morning, as well as on our lovely and amazing, wonderful syndicates, 18 at least across the country right now in all sorts of provinces all over the country. We'd like even more there, so if you are a fan of the show and want to help us promote, you can go ahead and contact your local radio station, tell them to pick us up too. We're trying to get to as many ears as possible, and one of the reasons we want to do that is we've got some great conversations we want to share with you today. We're going to be talking to Mark Brooks. Mark Brooks is a old friend of the show. We haven't heard from him in a while, sort of a Canadian partner, if you will. He's a journalist from Ottawa, produces his own blog as well, that does interviews and does national context as well, but focuses a little bit more on Ottawa than specifically than our show. Very much similar content, though. We're going to be talking to Mark in just a minute now. He was, among other things, we wanted to sort of check up on how he's been, see how things are going with over there at Earth Gauge, which is his blog. But also, he actually attended the most recent round of massive Keystone XL pipeline protests in the U.S. in Washington, D.C., so we're going to talk to him about that. After we talk to Mark, we're going to have Kevin Farmer around. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to come into the studio today, but we're going to get him on the line, throw around some news items for you. And then as well, we got one more TED Talks today. It's called Let's Prepare for Our New Climate. It's with Dr. Vicky, lawyer, Vicky Arroyo. She is a climate change consultant. She talks about planetary management strategies. So it's like a climate adaptation specialist, but she specializes in dealing with the entire world. How do we get everything on board? How do we deal with this as a global problem? Very, very interesting. And then we'll talk to Kevin a little bit about that after that finishes up a little bit later in the program. But right now, I do believe that we have Mark on the line. Mark, are you there?
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. How are you doing?
Doing pretty well. How about you, Darren?
Very good. I wanted to talk to you about a bunch of stuff, but I'd like to start with the one that kind of corresponds with a whole bunch of my headlines and was sort of one of the main reasons we wanted to talk to you today, which was you were in D.C. for the most recent round of protests for Keystone XL.
Yeah, last weekend.
Sure. Do you want to just describe a little bit of it, just in case people aren't entirely on the ball with what was going on there? Do you want to just describe what was happening before I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah, sure. So it was a Keystone protest for sure, but it was also just to urge President Obama to move forward on climate. So that was one of his campaign slogans, was forward. And 350.org and the Sierra Club and other organizations are pushing him hard now to move forward on climate change. And of course, he made reference to that in his inaugural address a couple weeks ago, dedicating quite a substantial portion of his speech to action on climate change. So now there's really a strong and broad movement ramping up to try to pressure President Obama to actually take some concrete action, and one of those actions would include denying the permit to build the Keystone XL pipeline.
All right. So my first question with regards to that is that we did have an interview a little while ago with somebody from the Canadian, which is another environmental aggregator site for environmental news here in Canada. And his perspective on that was that doing things like fighting individual pipelines was potentially a waste of time because it doesn't deal with the bigger issues, and a whole lot of sort of energy and investment goes into them. And then even if you succeed, it's a very minor victory. Obviously, you made the trip down there, so you thought it was worth your time. But could you just comment on that idea? Do you think that protesting individual projects like this is something that really is going to critically lead to further change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's symbolic. You know, if you look at that one pipeline, say, okay, well, how much difference will this make in the big picture? Is this going to solve the climate crisis? No, it's not. It's a symbolic gesture, and it would be, you know, quite remarkable, really, if President Obama were to deny this. It would send a message, and I think that's what climate activists are going for, is that he needs to send a message that he's serious about this issue, and he said just as much. So it's I mean, if you look at the emissions and the additional exploitation of the tar sands that's going to result from Keystone XL, in terms of global warming, it's a small percentage. But the idea is that we have to be leaving these fossil fuels in the ground. And this is something that U.S. climate activists can actually have an effect on. And it's part of a larger campaign. It would be a huge symbolic victory. And it would make a difference in terms of the momentum for the movement moving forward to try to stop other coal projects and fracking and other pipelines that are going to be proposed and are being proposed for further tar sands exploitation.
Absolutely. So I think one of the other things I've got, you've actually spawned way too many ideas in my head, so I'm going to try and sort them all out. I have so many questions about this to get your perspective on. One of them is that one of the attitudes, I watch a lot of American political coverage, and one of the sentiments from a lot of the progressive commentators and stuff that we get is that sometimes in the U.S. there's and I think this issue applies to Canada, but if, you know, for the time being we're talking about the U.S. Is that in American politics, a lot of people, it's so polarized, the political system, and as far as there being sort of two parties, and you're either in, you know, one camp or you're in the other camp, that a lot of the time a lot of people feel like it's difficult to criticize President Obama as a liberal because people assume that if you're not with the president, you're against him. Has that aspect played into this a lot? Have you found it difficult to get people on board with actually protesting a president that they themselves voted for?
You mean is it difficult for liberals to?
I guess yeah. Like, has there been any trouble where people are like, yeah, I know it's not great, but I don't like the idea of being opposed to the president that I support?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think that's an issue for people because, you know, he has actively sought out the support of the environmental movement. And so people are, you know, holding his feet to the fire to a certain extent, saying, okay, we gave you our support twice. You disappointed us the first time around for the first 4 years, and we're going to give you another shot at this. And your words have indicated that you are serious about the climate change problem, that this is an issue for future generations, that we have a moral responsibility to do something about this. And for people living around the climate, a lot of people who are going to be most impacted from this, and this, of course, that we're talking about developing and poor nations to a large extent, but also rich countries as well, and, of course, an obligation to future generations, that we have to take this issue extremely seriously. We know what the science is telling us. There's an overwhelming judgment of science that this is perhaps the most urgent issue of the 21st century, certainly of our generation. And so, you know, I think that climate activists and environmentalists are saying, listen, we support you, and we're holding you true to your word, and we expect you to do something about this. And if you're not true to your word, as you said you're going to be, then they're going to push. They're going to fight, and we're going to see more of that.
All right. Now, so speaking on that, carrying on that theme, there was an article from Wednesday, February 20th in The Guardian talking about the pipeline. It was quoting Alex Purbakes, the TransCanada's president for oil and energy pipelines. He was quoted as saying, you could shut down oil sands production tomorrow and it would have absolutely no measurable effect on climate change. I just wondering if, before we get into that a little bit further, if you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I mean,
is this really a big deal? I mean, I know you said that it was, you know, a landmark as far as support.
Yeah.
Is actually shutting down this pipeline going to do anything? I mean, he was saying that shutting down the entire oil sands wouldn't do anything. So if you just comment on that.
I mean, first of all, it's not true. I mean, it's
that's the easy answer.
You know, it's this argument that a lot of fossil fuel advocates or oil industry representatives will use and say that, well, if we, you know, the tar sands, it's only a small percentage of global emissions, and unless we do something about China and the coal plants there, then it won't make any difference. But it's this argument as if to suggest that, you know, this is a problem of multiple sources. And any one source contributes to this problem. And so, yes, we have to also deal with coal plants. Yes, we have to deal with fracking. We have to deal with all sorts of emission sources. But one of them is tar sands. And to suggest that it makes no difference on climate change is simply not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know for a fact that the tar sands are Canada's largest single source of emissions. So if Canada is serious in any way, and our federal government has shown no interest in this file, but if we were to be actually serious about dealing with climate change and doing our moral and taking our moral responsibility to do something about our carbon emissions in this country, we have to deal with the tar sands. We have to deal with the emissions coming from the single largest source in Canada by far. And it's growing at a rapid rate. And with these new pipelines that are being proposed, if they come online, it's just going to increase exponentially. So it would make, if the tar sands were to be shut down tomorrow, which is not going to happen, and nobody is really even asking or expecting that to happen, it would make a huge dent in Canada's emissions. But again, what we're looking for, I think, is to actually have a plan to reduce emissions from the tar sands. and to put the brakes on this massive industrial project. So it's I think it's morally irresponsible to make the argument that, oh, the tar sands is just one source of emissions, and in the global scheme of things, it makes no difference, when clearly that's not the case. And we know from science, and a lot of research has been done, in fact, that tar sands, the full exploitation of the tar sands, there was a report that came out a couple months ago by Andrew Weaver at the University of Victoria, saying that he calculated that the tar sands, the full exploitation of the tar sands, would result in almost 0.4 degrees of warming globally. And it doesn't sound like much, but since the Industrial Revolution, we've only seen 0.8 degrees of warming. Okay, so and the result of that has been all the extreme weather we've been witnessing mm-hmm. around the world, droughts and floods and hurricanes, superstorms, you name it. So the tar sands would contribute another 0.4 degrees of warming. That is significant, if we were to exploit the tar sands completely. And there's every indication that that is, in fact, the intention of the governments of Alberta and the federal government of Canada to exploit the tar sands as completely and as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think one of the Bill McKibben, of course, from 350.org was very 350 was very much involved with the Keystone protests, very much a catalyst for that in a lot of ways, especially the last one and then this one as well. And one of the sort of soundbite, Bill McKibben's very, very good at sort of condensing ideas and sort of making his arguments into soundbites. And one of them that I thought was very to the point on that was, why are we even talking about digging up more oil when science tells us that we can't afford to burn the oil we've already got?
Yeah.
Well, that's really that simple.
that's right, and that's a really key point. He actually did some of the calculations on how much fossil fuel reserves remain, known reserves around the world, and then compared that to this ubiquitous 2-degree target that we hear about, that the planet cannot afford. Climate scientists tell us that we cannot afford any more than 2 degrees of warming, and as I say, we already have 0.8 degrees of warming. We've already experienced 0.8 degrees. Since we started burning fossil fuels. So we have 1.2 degrees of wiggle room. And if we exploit all the known fossil fuel reserves around the planet, we would vastly overshoot that 2-degree target. So based on the calculations he did, he figures that we can only exploit about 1/5 of remaining fossil fuel known reserves. And that means that most of the fossil fuel, most of the oil and gas, most of the coal has to remain in the ground. And that's why campaigns such as the Keystone XL campaign and campaigns to slow down exploitation of the tar sands are so important, because it is a vast source of carbon. James Hansen has called the tar sands a carbon bomb, and building pipelines from the tar sands are like fuses to this carbon bomb.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even the quote there further down the article from the same guy from TransCanada was saying, you know, simple math tells us, therefore, that the oil sands represent only 0.1% of the global greenhouse emissions. But, I mean, a lot of this is sort of part of that trouble with numbers. People throw around numbers a lot. And in that case, the trouble with those numbers that he's using, aside from the fact that he's fudged a whole bunch of the numbers, I mean, even if you grant him his bad math, is that that's only dealing with the actual extraction of the tar from the tar sands, not dealing with transportation, not dealing with refining, not dealing with it being burned as fuel in cars mm-hmm. or any of that stuff. So
yeah, exactly.
You know, people have to be aware of the fact that 0.1% when we're talking about, you know, the climate is actually a massive number. It sounds small, but it's a massive, massive impact.
Yeah.
But it's also the numbers aren't true.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. I mean, when you reduce an enormous number down to 100, which is effectively what you're doing when you're making it a percentage, it sounds like a really small number when you know. But that percentage is actually in emissions terms, in megatons of carbon, is enormous. And you often hear that argument used in Canada and saying, well, tar sands only account for 6.5% of Canada's emissions. It doesn't sound like very much. By the way, that's rising rapidly. Mm-hmm. By last count, it was about 6.5% of Canada's emissions. And you think, well, that's not a very big number. But, as I said, it is the single largest source of Canadian emissions. And 6.5% as a single source is enormous, if you think about it. I mean, that is more, if you think about how many cars and trucks are out on the road, the buildings that we heat, all the transportation fuel we need, all the ways in which we use fossil fuels, one single source in Canada is responsible for 6.5% of our total emissions. And so, yeah, you have to always be a little bit leery when you hear these percentages. And as you say, you point out very well, Darren, how are these numbers calculated? Are they including the so-called well-to-wheel emissions, or is it just the exploitation of the tar sands, but not the actual burning of the fuel in the gas tank and so on?
Yeah, I just another way to sort of have fun with numbers around that too is people, again, if we say we grant him all of his math and that the 0.1% is actually accurate, context is everything. And the example I came up with that was, if somebody came up to you and offered, said, I'm going to give you 0.1% of my yearly income to do my job for me, you'd be like, that's a terrible deal. But then you find out that the guy's Bill Gates and his job is sitting on a yacht, and all of a sudden it's an amazing deal.
Right?
So context is absolutely everything.
It's a great point. Suddenly that 0.1% translates into several million dollars or something.
Yeah, exactly. So we can leave that behind for a little bit. You've been up to a lot more than just going to the Keystone protest. We've been out of touch for a little while, so it's not even like a bait question. I don't even know what you're going to say, but if you want to just tell us a little bit, people who maybe haven't been listening to the show for a long time don't know about Earth Gauge. If you want to just tell them a little bit about that project and what you've been up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So we worked together a little bit when I was doing some environmental programming at CKUT in Montreal, and since then I moved to Ottawa. And was given an opportunity to host and produce an environment program on CKCU at Carleton. And so I'm doing that now, and it's been going really well. And that's Thursday mornings. I do an environment show, which, as you mentioned, is somewhat similar to what you guys, the great work you're doing on the Green Majority. But it is a little bit more Ottawa-focused, so we have a lot of local environmental stories. And, of course, being the capital of Canada, we have a political dimension. We managed to get some politicians on the show here and there and talk about federal environmental regulations and that kind of thing.
So one of the things I was noticing this morning, I was reading to you from one of the Guardian articles that that was quoting TransCanada boss a lot. There was a whole bunch of them that we found for this week's show, and I actually got quite irritated when I was reading them, but in the way that reminds me why I do this show, and I wanted your comment on this as well, because I know you read a lot of news, probably more than I do, to be honest.
I don't know about that.
But as far as the environment stuff, and one of the things that just it frustrates me and then reminds me why I do the show, which is that even when there's the journalist is attempting to do a fair story or attempting to even do a positive story for the environment, environmental reporting in the traditional media is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely terrible. And I just, like, there's even one, I'm going to post it online. I won't take up a whole bunch of time by trying to paraphrase an article that I hated, but it really didn't seem like the journalist, and I'm not going to out them on air. You can check the website if you're interested in what I'm referring to. I'll post it and make a note of it on the website afterwards, but it's just bad. They're, you know, misunderstanding concepts, using sort of what I find that happens a lot in the news is that, unbeknownst to the journalist, they'll take sort of oil industry or lobbyist talking points about the environmentalists' points of view, not realizing that it's sort of, you know, it's the point of view as given to you by the opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. And it just really frustrates me. So I know you read just as much news as I do, probably. So it just, if you want to comment on that at all about sort of where you feel, having over the past few years, the sort of state of environmental reporting, do you get the same feeling that I do? Do you get frustrated when you read the news?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's particularly when it comes to climate change. I don't know what you're referring to was a climate change.
It was actually specifically about the Keystone, but I just mean like in a general sense.
Yeah, I mean, I share your same frustration. I think for whatever reason, I'm not suggesting it's intentional, but some of the environment reporting is leaves a lot to be desired, let's put it that way. And some of it is just incorrect. And you know, there's always this tendency in journalism or this desire to present both sides of the story, and that becomes, for an issue like climate change, it becomes incredibly frustrating because, you know, I did an interview for last week's show with Dr. Eric Galbraith of McGill University. He's a climate scientist. And, you know, he was expressing a lot of these same frustrations. And I asked him, why does there seem to be this ongoing debate in the media about climate science and the fact that whether or not the world is warming and humans are responsible? And he said, you know what, it's beyond my capacity to understand. I go to these climate conferences on a regular basis, and there is no disagreement among climate scientists. There's no real disagreement. Sure, there is some debate about what the impacts might be, how much warming we're going to witness. But the fact that warming is happening, the fact that humans are to blame, is just accepted fact. And that's saying something, because these are scientists who, by they tend to be skeptical by nature. They tend to disagree with each other. But on this particular issue, there's virtually no disagreement. But you would not know that by reading about climate change in particular, but also some other environmental issues. You not necessarily know or get that feeling from reading these stories in the media. So it can be certainly frustrating, and it just means that the important work that your show is doing in trying to tell people the truth of what's actually going on.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of people may not realize. I think it makes a very interesting comparison. Is that there actually is? You can look it up. There actually is, in 2013, the educated North American people who are part of what's called a Flat Earth Society, where they think that all science is not, this is all, we've all been deceived and the Earth is actually still flat. These people actually do exist. So there was a comment by one of my favorite commentators who said that showing both sides of the climate change debate is no more to the point than just saying to both sides to the gravity debate.
Yeah.
Yes, you will find someone who doesn't agree, but that doesn't mean they're worth listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a valid comparison. I mean, there are still people out there who, probably believe the Earth is flat, but there are certainly people who believe the Earth is only 6,000 years old. I mean, that there's no question about that. They completely reject the theory of evolution. So, you're just not going to convince everybody. And on climate change, there are always going to be people who just won't believe it. And you can present them with any amount of science and any amount of evidence, and they simply won't believe it for whatever reason. So, but the media have a responsibility to report, to report what we know, and what we know is very clear. There is no debate, and the climate scientists are telling us that we have to take this issue seriously and act urgently, and we're simply not doing that. And I think, I don't want to say the media are responsible for our inaction. Clearly, that's not the case, but I think we could be doing a much better job at letting people know that there's very little debate in terms of the climate science.
Absolutely. Well, I think we can, on that note, what we should say is right before we had the interview, I made a pitch to people if they wanted to get us on their local radio station, to contact their local radio station. I'll add one more further to that. If you read an article about the climate change or any environmental topic that just drives you bonkers, email the person who wrote it and ask them to have either Mark or I comment on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Good idea.
Absolutely.
Mark,
it was an absolute pleasure to have you on again. I'm sorry it's been so long since we've spoken. If you want to just tell people how to get in contact with you again, that would be really great. It was great having you on again today.
Yeah, sure. And I look forward to working with you some more, Darren. People can check out my website, the show website, which is earthgage.ca. Pretty easy to remember. The show is called Earth Gage Radio, and the website is earthgage.ca. You can email me at earthgageradio@gmail.com. And I look forward to working with you some more in the future, Darren.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Mark.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to go to a music break now. That, of course, was Mark Brooks from Earth Gage Blog. I'm sure you will hear from him again shortly, but for now, we're going to take a brief music break, and we'll be back to talk to Kevin Farmer about some more news items. Stay tuned.
We all know it's a fact. From the things that you said, I guess there's no going back. And I won't give up that easy. And I won't ever stop dreaming of you in a white dress staring at me. I'll take your hand and I'll remember. I will always fight, I will sing you a lullaby. wonder. I know that we fight, but if we turn out the lights, I swear we'll make up all night. And I won't give up that easy, and I won't ever stop dreaming of you in a white dress.
Right, we're back. I'm Darren Kaster, your host. You're listening to The Green Majority here, produced at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and on our community radio partners, fantastic that they are, all the way across the country. And we're going to be talking now to Kevin Farmer, of course, our co-host. Kevin, unfortunately, was not able to make it into the studio today, but as always, he makes an effort and is phoning in today. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm good, Darren.
So we had a bunch of stuff today, but the one that the article that really caught my eye this morning, because I was just sort of in a fresh conversation about this yesterday, talking about consumption and meat and what a massive resource drain that meat is, and yet I'm simply not able to commit to being a full vegetarian myself. So my sort of, you can call it a rationalization if you like, but my attitude on that has always been that, you know, if everybody just ate a little bit less meat, then we wouldn't need everybody to eat no meat. And we have an article now coming from The Guardian that pretty much based on pretty much says that, based now on some wide ranging studies. This certainly wasn't the first one, but just recommending it was more of a comment piece based off some more research that was done, just about all the damage from the actual meat industry, chemical dead zones, toxic algal blooms due to all the pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and the water consumption. Meat sounds really, really bad. You yourself are a vegetarian or a vegan, Kevin?
I'm a vegan.
A vegan. And how long have you been doing that?
Very long time now. I don't even remember.
Longer than you can remember. Well, that's certainly longer than me. So what is your perspective on that? Do you sort of think that, I mean, that's a choice that you've made for yourself, but are you sort of in the boat that you think everybody eventually should be vegan, or do you agree with the article that if we just sort of get everybody to do a little bit less, that's good enough, or what is your feeling having read the article?
Well, okay, so, you know, reading the article, I would say having meat consumption isn't enough. He's trying to soft sell a point to make it more palatable. Pardon the pun.
Accepted. I like that one.
Yeah. I don't believe as we one of the consequences of industrializing the developing nations is that their diets also changed to a Western diet, and so meat consumption is rising in places like China and India, and we've already seen that the seas, the oceans, are on the brink of wholesale species collapse, and we're also painfully aware that we're running out of land, and the conversion of plant protein into animal protein is a very, very wasteful exercise. You know, for the amount of grain it takes to make 1 pound of cow, you take something like 14 pounds of grain to make a pound of cow, and each and every one of those pounds of grain was more nutritious than the pound of cow that it went to producing. And that's just sort of the I don't know what you would call that kind of trade-off, the nutritional trade-off. But you know, then there's the unimaginable amounts of water diversion that go into raising livestock, and the amount of water pollution. Like when you look at intensive hog farming, an average-sized intensive pig farm produces as much waste as a small city, and it goes into the environment untreated, and it goes on and on and on. Like without even mentioning sort of ethical views about you know, animal treatment and so on, without sort of even broaching you know, ethical issues at all. Livestock farming is really sort of a disaster environmentally, and it appropriates huge tracts of land as well that could be diverted to other uses. Now, in the UK, for instance, there's some agricultural land that's only suitable for grazing cattle. So, I mean, you know, if we were to eat locally based on what our land could produce, in some regions you would still find it would make sense for them to produce meat. But it's much less than just having meat consumption. I would say, like, you know, getting meat consumption down to around, you know, 10-15% maybe is probably more appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, that's as you mentioned at the beginning, there is taking into account the fact that meanwhile, the places like China and India, their meat consumption is skyrocketing, right? So, I mean, North America is pretty level. It's raising, but it's the real big expansion is with the industrialization and just generally being more a richer country, richer countries in general as a country, being able to afford more. A lot of that is going into meat. One of the other statistics that kind of popped up here as you're going through is that meat production accounts, from the article here, it says meat production accounts for 80% of the nitrogen and phosphorus used in farming. And then if people will remember as well, as you mentioned as well, as far as algal blooms, all these heavy, heavy elements get into the waterways. This creates algal blooms and creates sea dead zones. So there's an important link, I think, that needs to be made that you mentioned, but I want to sort of hammer home one more time as well, is that you can't really think of things like sea farming or ocean health, or whether you're talking about a resource consumption point of view or just like an ocean health point of view, is inextricably linked to land farming, because that's where most of the waste goes.
Oh yeah, runoff from farms is a serious problem, and the over nitrogenization of the water is also a serious problem. Like since it was discovered how to since it was discovered how to extract nitrogen from the atmosphere and use it for fertilizer, we've released billions and billions and billions of tons of nitrogen into the environment, and we essentially set off a nitrogen bomb, and that has altered the ecosystems globally. But like you say, the runoff is a serious problem. The nutrients go into the water and creates toxic algal blooms and dead zones where no fish can live. And runoff is a problem in Australia when it comes to the Great Barrier Reef. It's a significant problem, and it's one of those things that I like to point out. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around the scale of domestic of livestock farming, and when you realize just how many resources get diverted to this, especially water, and you realize the scale of what's going on, and you realize, you know, the loss of nutrition. That's why it's sort of, I like to come back to the loss of nutrition, that it's just inefficient to, you know, take salmon farming. You know, we're scooping the seas dry to feed salmon farms because salmon is a predator, and we're eating too high up on the food chain. But now everyone's demanding salmon. But in order to support salmon, which is a predator, we have to basically mine the seas for every other kind of fish to keep those farms running.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to house 10 billion people on this planet in anything approaching environmental harmony, we're going to have to eat a plant-based diet, or a significantly plant-based diet, and we're going to have to eat much lower on the food chain, and we're going to have to. And part of the problem is that we simply can't claim as much land as we're claiming. We have to leave some land left over for the wild to continue to perform its natural functions. So I think. Yeah, like I said, I think half is optimistic.
All right. Well, I think I eat far less than half the amount of meat consumption that most people do. But to balance out for the odd person that's not gonna be struck by this issue, I will try and reduce it even further if I can, just for you, Kevin.
Because
I know it bothers you. One of the other things I just want to mention here, I want to make sure we have time to go to this pre-record, so we're going to go to it, but just a quick comment on this as well. We tend to, when we're talking about these issues, I tend to stay away from the ethical side of the argument, and that's not because I'm afraid to talk about it. It's not because I don't think it's important to talk about it. It's that I think that when we're talking about ethics, I don't think it's really useful to have everybody listen to just my opinion about that. I mean, the ethics is something that we sort of decide as a society, right? So what I'd like to do on this, because I have been meaning to deal more with the ethical side of meat consumption in this issue, is that I did an interview for Alternatives Journal that we didn't play on the air, but I do have access to. I may end up using it on the show, but it was with Joanne MacArthur, who's done a whole bunch of photography around the abuse of animals and factory farming and this sort of thing, and they do something where there's vigils where they go and stand outside meat packing plants and kind of say goodbye. It's all very sad. Say goodbye to animals as they're going and sort of try and guilt the truck drivers, I guess, into feeling bad about trucking all this helpless animals to their doom. So we're going to go, and I'm going to do that at some point. I hope to do that sometime in the next few weeks. And I just want to let people know that it's not that I don't want to deal with that, or that I don't acknowledge that sort of ethical side is an important side. Is that I want to get someone else's opinion besides just mine. So we will plan to come back to that in the future. But I will leave it there for now, Kevin. We're going to go to our other pre-record, and then we'll come back to talk about one or two more news items at the end of the show. But for now, we're going to go to lawyer Vicky Arroyo, who's working with U.S. policymakers to talk about planetary management strategies. This is from a TED Talk called Let's Prepare for Our New Climate.
This is the skyline of my hometown, New Orleans. It was a great place to grow up, but it's one of the most vulnerable spots in the world. Half the city is already below sea level. In 2005, the world watched as New Orleans and the Gulf Coast were devastated by Hurricane Katrina. 1,836 people died. Nearly 300,000 homes were lost. These are my mother's at the top, although that's not her car. It was carried there by floodwaters up to the roof. And that's my sister's below. Fortunately, they and other family members got out in time, but they lost their homes, and as you can see, just about everything in them. Other parts of the world have been hit by storms in even more devastating ways. In 2008, Cyclone Nargis and its aftermath killed 138,000 in Myanmar. Climate change is affecting our homes, our communities, our way of life. We should be preparing at every scale and at every opportunity. This talk is about being prepared for and resilient to the changes that are coming and that will affect our homes and our collective home, the Earth. The changes in these times won't affect us all equally. There are important distributional consequences, and they're not what you always might think. In New Orleans, the elderly and female-headed households were among the most vulnerable. For those in vulnerable, low-lying nations, how do you put a dollar value on losing your country, where your ancestors are buried? And where will your people go? And how will they cope in a foreign land? Will there be tensions over immigration or conflicts over competition for limited resources? It's already fueled conflicts in Chad and Darfur. Like it or not, ready or not, this is our future. Sure, some are looking for opportunities in this new world. That's the Russians planting a flag on the ocean bottom to stake a claim for minerals under the receding Arctic sea ice. But while there might be some short-term individual winners, Our collective losses will far outweigh them. Look no further than the insurance industry as they struggle to cope with mounting catastrophic losses from extreme weather events. The military gets it. They call climate change a threat multiplier that could harm stability and security, while governments around the world are evaluating how to respond. So what can we do? How can we prepare and adapt? I'd like to share three sets of examples, starting with adapting to violent storms and floods. In New Orleans, the I-10 twin spans, with sections knocked out in Katrina, have been rebuilt 21 feet higher to allow for greater storm surge. And these raised and energy-efficient homes were developed by Brad Pitt and Make It Right for the hard-hit 9th Ward. The devastated church my mom attends has been not only rebuilt higher, it's poised to become the first Energy Star church in the country. They're selling electricity back to the grid thanks to solar panels, reflective paint, and more. Their March electricity bill was only $48. Now, these are examples of New Orleans rebuilding in this way, but better if others act proactively with these changes in mind. For example, in Galveston, here's a resilient home that survived Hurricane Ike when others on neighboring lots clearly did not. And around the world, satellites and warning systems are saving lives in flood-prone areas such as Bangladesh. But as important as technology and infrastructure are, perhaps the human element is even more critical. We need better planning and systems for evacuation. We need to better understand how people make decisions in times of crisis and why. While it's true that many who died in Katrina did not have access to transportation, others who did refused to leave as the storm approached, often because available transportation and shelters refused to allow them to take their pets. Imagine leaving behind your own pet in an evacuation or a rescue. Fortunately, in 2006, Congress passed the Pet Evacuation and Transportation Standards Act. It spells pets to change that. Second, preparing for heat and drought. Farmers are facing challenges of drought from Asia to Africa, from Australia to Oklahoma, while heat waves linked with climate change have killed tens of thousands of people in Western Europe in 2003 and again in Russia in 2010. In Ethiopia, 70%, that's 70% of the population, depends on rainfall for its livelihood. Oxfam and Swiss Re, together with Rockefeller Foundation, are helping farmers like this one build hillside terraces and find other ways to conserve water. But they're also providing for insurance when the droughts do come. The stability this provides is giving the farmers the confidence to invest. It's giving them access to affordable credit. It's allowing them to become more productive so that they can afford their own insurance over time without assistance. It's a virtuous cycle and one that could be replicated throughout the developing world. After a lethal 1995 heat wave turned refrigerator trucks from the popular Taste of Chicago festival into makeshift morgues, Chicago became a recognized leader, tamping down on the urban heat island impact through opening cooling centers, outreach to vulnerable neighborhoods, planting trees, creating cool white or vegetated green roofs. This is City Hall's green roof next to Cook County's roof, which is 77 degrees Fahrenheit hotter at the surface. Washington, D.C., last year, actually led the nation in new green roofs installed. And they're funding this in part thanks to a 5-cent tax on plastic bags. They're splitting the cost of installing these green roofs with home and building owners. The roofs not only temper urban heat island impact, but they save energy and therefore money, the emissions that cause climate change, and they also reduce stormwater runoff. So some solutions to heat can provide for win-win-wins. Third, adapting to rising seas. Sea level rise threatens coastal ecosystems, agriculture, even major cities. This is what 1 to 2 meters of sea level rise looks like in the Mekong Delta. That's where half of Vietnam's rice is grown. Infrastructure is going to be affected. Airports around the world are located on the coast. It makes sense, right? There's open space. The planes can take off and land without worrying about creating noise or avoiding tall buildings. Here's just one example, San Francisco Airport, with 16 inches or more of flooding. Imagine the staggering cost of protecting this vital infrastructure with levees. But there might be some changes in store that you might not imagine. For example, Planes require more runway for takeoff because the heated, less dense air provides for less lift. San Francisco is also spending $40 million to rethink and redesign its water and sewage treatment, as water outfall pipes like this one can be flooded with seawater, causing backups at the plant, harming the bacteria that are needed to treat the waste. So these outfall pipes have been retrofitted to shut seawater off from entering the system. Beyond these technical solutions, our work at the Georgetown Climate Center with communities encourages them to look at what existing legal and policy tools are available and to consider how they can accommodate change. For example, in land use, which areas do you want to protect through adding a seawall, for example, alter by raising buildings, or retreat from to allow the migration of important natural systems, such as wetlands or beaches? Other examples to consider. In the UK, the Thames Barrier protects London from storm surge. The Asian City's Climate Resilience Network is restoring vital ecosystems like forest mangroves. These are not only important ecosystems in their own right, but they also serve as a buffer to protect inland communities. New York City is incredibly vulnerable to storms, as you can see from this clever sign, and to sea level rise and to storm surge, as you can see from the subway flooding. But back above ground, these raised ventilation grates for the subway system show that solutions can be both functional and attractive. In fact, in New York, San Francisco, and London, designers have envisioned ways to better integrate the natural and built environments with climate change in mind. I think these are inspiring examples of what's possible when we feel empowered to plan for a world that will be different. But now, a word of caution. Adaptation is too important to be left to the experts. Why? Well, there are no experts. We're entering uncharted territory, and yet our expertise and our systems are based on the past. Stationarity is the notion that we can anticipate the future based on the past and plan accordingly. And this principle governs much of our engineering, our design of critical infrastructure, city water systems, building codes, even water rights and other legal precedents. But we can simply no longer rely on established norms. We're operating outside the bounds of CO2 concentrations that this planet has seen for hundreds of thousands of years. The larger point I'm trying to make is this. It's up to us to look at our homes and our communities, our vulnerabilities and our exposures to risk, and to find ways to not just survive, but to thrive. And it's up to us to plan and to prepare and to call on our government leaders and require them to do the same, even while they address the underlying causes of climate change. There are no quick fixes. There are no one-size-fits-all solutions. We're all learning by doing. But the operative word is doing. Thank you.
And we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. That great music we were just playing there and a little bit earlier in the show, of course, I want to remind everybody is courtesy of the wonderful and amazing DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog. There is a link to her website on ours as well. She also writes little reviews of each independent track that is picked for each week's show. Our show music is entirely 100% Canadian content, and she has a really, really great blog. But if you're interested at all in trying to find any of these songs, a lot of the time the songs are even available free for download, completely legal, because these are indie bands and stuff, and they've put up some of their tracks for free. So if you like any of the music at all, definitely check out our show page, and then you can follow a link off our show page, which has descriptions of the actual songs we've been playing to Open Till Midnight, where she's just got a ton of great content. Definitely check her out. And I happen to know that she's got some contests going on right now for Canadian Music Week, which she's giving away some contest prizes for simple stuff. You don't even have to really do anything. I think it's like if you're a new addition to her Twitter feed or something like that, you can be entered for some great prizes. So definitely go and check her out. You just check that out on our website as a link to her website, which is greenmajority.ca, where you can get all the stuff. The show's posted afterwards, linked to all the news articles that we're talking about, just about everything there. We try and post and link and cross-reference and do all sorts of cool stuff. Of course, you can also find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us just about anywhere. I've even Googled my name once in a while to find out where we are. LinkedIn, where else? We could find us anywhere you like. But for now, we've only got about 6 minutes left. So Kevin Farmer, I've got you back on the line here. We just wanted to deal with one more headline before we had to go today. And that was talking about invasive species. So very relevant to what we were just talking about before with the meat consumption. But your initial reaction to the study that this article was talking about?
Well, so it's one of those things that had kind of fallen off my radar, actually. You know, there was, it was top of mind a couple of years ago when invasive species in the Great Lakes was making a lot of news, and we realized, you know, how thoroughly we had altered that ecosystem with something like 300 invasive species, you know, colonizing the Great Lakes. And, certainly there's been other, you know, spectacular examples of failure, you know, the devastation that can be wrought by introducing invasive species. Just the history of invasive species in Australia is enough to make you cry. there's so much bad environmental news that it kind of fell off my radar for a while, and it just kind of brought it back home. I'm like, oh yeah, and then there's that, you know, as we continue to sort of watch the unfolding effects of human impacts on the environment. You know, alien species is a much big, it turns out to be a bigger problem than we've been giving it credit for. And in a conservative estimate in Europe is that it's costing the economy $12 billion a year, or €12 billion,
which would be close to roughly to $18 billion.
Yeah,
somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, which would be even more, and that's just the economic cost. Like, when you look at ecosystems as life support mechanisms for planet Earth, and you realize that they can only withstand so many impacts. You know, there's loss of habitat, there's pollution, just the general reduction of biodiversity and what that means for ecosystems, and then there's this added pressure from invasive species, and you just have to, and when you realize that the problem is global and that it's so pervasive and that it's you know, in fact getting worse because the world just continues to get smaller and smaller, and we introduce more and more species into new ecosystems all the time, especially with, you know, farming practices where the article mentions even some of the fast-growing water plants that are being considered for biofuels. You know, that they're extremely fast-growing, and if they get out, you know, who's to say what the effects would be when they compete with slower-growing plants for sunlight.
Sure, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think of all the things we talked about this week, this is the article that I think people really should take the time to look up and read. Now, I'm going to put it right at the top of the list because it brings up, I mean, we probably, Kevin and you and I could probably spend an entire show talking about all the different facets of the information that's in here. I mean, it covers a million different issues. It talks about like global health having to do with like mosquitoes changing their ranges and bringing dengue fever, for instance, to Italy in 2007. They've got things like zebra mussels. We've got the like geopolitical issues here around like food production and crop production. I mean, it seems like such a small subset. You know, invasive species seems like such a small subset of all the different issues that we're dealing with, but it really is the canary in the mine. I mean, this is the way invasive species, I think, should be talked about, should be more to be talk about it in the context of species are the canary in the coal mine, and right now they're freaking out. Like everything's going everywhere. It's almost like trying to play a game of Risk with friends, except that your life depends on getting your life depends on finishing the game, and halfway through the game, somebody completely changes all the rules and doesn't tell you what the new rules are. I mean, we're in the middle of this global system basically trying to recalibrate itself to a whole bunch of new unknowns, talking about ocean acidification levels, levels in the atmosphere of various gases, temperature and seasonal changes, temperature changes. Basically, the entire system's gone haywire, and what we're seeing with this, these 10,000 alien species just in Europe, and again, they said that was a conservative number, as well as the impact was a very, very conservative number, was this is just the natural world trying to sort out what we've done to the climate and to the water and to everything else. They're trying to find a place to survive. So I mean, I don't even really like saying invasive species. These are species that are desperately trying to adapt to a climate and ecological system that we've destroyed, I think is a much, much better way to put it.
Well, and as you commented there, this is a situation which is only going to accelerate with climate change as climate bands shift. For instance, more and more subarctic fish are being found in the Arctic, and they're going to be, and as the ice melts, they're going to be exploited as fisheries. But species migration is simply an inevitable consequence of moving climate bands around on the Earth, and so as you say, with the introduction of new parasites and whatnot, this is only going to get worse.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I do really recommend people read that article, but that's all the time we've got for Kevin Farmer. Thank you so much for making the effort to call in today and joining us.
Thanks, Darren.
And we'll talk to everybody next week. As we said, check out greenmajority.ca. Links to all the stuff we talked about today is on the website, as well as the show, so you can go back and read some of the articles we were talking about, listen to the show, check anything you like, send us emails, Twitter, Facebook, all that great stuff. Basically, if you just do anything and look for Green Majority, you'll find us. Other than that, have a great week, and we'll talk to everybody next week.